Thank you everyone for coming. Welcome to the Lowy Institute and welcome to today's event, Backslides, Baby Steps, or Business as Usual, Exploring Human Rights in China. My name is Meriden Varal and I'm the East Asia Program Director here at the Lowy Institute. I'd like to acknowledge that this event is being held on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay respect to elders past and present. Now, in June 1989, after several weeks of demonstrations around the country, Chinese troops entered Tiananmen Square and opened fire at unarmed civilians. Estimates of how many people were killed range from several hundreds to thousands. The Chinese government has not acknowledged what happened. Since then, the issue of human rights in China has been on the agenda of many international actors, and most would argue that the situation has not improved in recent years. Despite being a signatory to the UN Declaration on Human Rights and playing an important role in drafting that, activists and international organisations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders have drawn attention to what they describe as an increasingly repressive environment in China since Xi Jinping became president in 2012. For example, increased restrictions on academic freedoms. Xi Jinping called for intellectuals to be patriotic in order to have a good career. China's surveillance apparatus, including networks of cameras with extremely high-tech facial recognition capabilities to monitor people's movements, and of course the social credit system, which monitors individuals' behaviour with a view to shaping it in certain socially acceptable ways across a range of areas by creating a social credit score, which can then be used to restrict people's abilities to do things like travel or buy a house or send your kids to certain schools. Repression of ethnic minorities, particularly in areas such as Tibet and Xinjiang, including the use of political re-education camps in Xinjiang, where people can be detained indefinitely for an enormously wide range of activities, are some examples of these repressions in China that many organisations have argued have become worse under Xi Jinping. Now, in China, many people see the situation rather differently. Despite all of this that I've just outlined, at the end of 2017, China announced a year of remarkable progress on human rights. Now, part of this pronouncement is very likely to be a heavy-handed attempt to reshape narratives after poet, activist, and Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo died in China. But denying that its human rights record is as egregious as many argue may not entirely be just a cynical act of whitewashing. In the Chinese rhetoric, in the way that the Chinese official discourses run, the focus on human rights is less about the right to individual freedoms to do things, but more of a focus on freedom from things, such as freedom from poverty or freedom from social instability and conflict. The Chinese government points, for example, to the anti-corruption drive, legal reforms, and the huge success of people lifting people out of poverty as ways that it has increased living standards and human rights of the Chinese people. Many people within China, that I, for example, that I know personally and know quite well, talk about how they agree with this focus on material well-being, the right to not be hungry, the right to be warm, the right to have a home, and social stability, the right to live without conflict, as that they prefer those over rights which to them seem a little bit intellectual or a bit esoteric, such as freedom of speech. There's recently released research that suggests that the social credit system is actually seen quite positively by many Chinese. They say that they're less concerned about loss of privacy and rather see the system as a means of promoting honesty and fairness in social interactions. So the picture is extremely complicated. Today we're going to look at the current situation of human rights in China and ask whether or not the Chinese Communist Party has been trying to improve the situation, and if so, in what ways and to what degrees of success, and for whom. We're also going to talk a little bit about how different governments and organisations around the world have attempted to influence the human rights situation in China and how effective these approaches have been. To do so, I'm joined by Sophie Richardson and Natasha De Silva. Sophie Richardson is the China Director at Human Rights Watch, which is a non-profit, non-government international organisation with the goal of fighting human rights abuses around the world. Sophie has been working in this capacity on human rights in China since 2006. A graduate of the University of Virginia, the Hopkins Nanjing program, Ms. Richardson is the author of numerous articles on domestic political reform, democratisation and human rights in China and Hong Kong and other parts of Asia as well. A renowned China expert, Ms. Richardson has testified before the European Parliament, then the US Senate and House of Representatives, and provided commentary for leading news outlets like the BBC, CNN and the New York Times. So welcome, Sophie, and thank you very much for joining us today. We are also joined by Natasha Da Silva, who's the Director of Engagement and Partnerships at the Australian Human Rights Commission, where she oversees Australia's international human rights engagement. For the past 11 years, Natasha has been managing the Human Rights Technical Cooperation Program, which implements practical programs on human rights across China, both at national and subnational levels. She's worked with Chinese government partners such as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Civil Affairs, Ministry of Justice, the Supreme People's Court, and the Ministry of Public Security to implement these practical programs on human rights. Prior to this role, Ms. Silva was Director of International Programs and Development at the Human Rights Commission, where she led high-level programs targeting domestic violence in China. So as you can see, we've got some very profound expertise on the issue here, and I'm looking forward to having a good discussion. The way we're going to do this is that we're going to have a discussion among the panel at first, and then for the last 20 minutes or so, I'll open the conversation up to questions from the floor. I will emphasise, please, that this for the questions, please keep them to short questions and brief questions rather than comments. But we'll get to that when we get to that. So I'd like to start, if I could, Sophie, with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the current situation of human rights in China? What's changed in recent years? Just give us a bit of an overview of how things look.
Sure. Well, first, thanks very much for having me this afternoon. It's great to be here at Lowy. Under Xi Jinping, we have noted a number of trends I can try to summarize succinctly for you. One of them has been the adoption of a slew of laws that really gut and or reverse some of the legal gains that we saw in the 90s and the aughts. And here I'm referring particularly to laws on things like counterterrorism or national security, on cybersecurity. And to a large extent, those have overshadowed, I think rightly in our view, some of the modest gains that have been made in other areas, such as the adoption of an anti-domestic violence law, which was long in the works. And you know, it's not a flawless piece of legislation, but it's better to have that than not. But some of these other laws are enormously problematic, and we see the government using them to prosecute behavior that is clearly protected under international law. We spent a great deal of the last year documenting abuses of surveillance technology, that ranges from the forced collection of DNA samples from people under the guise of free public health care programs without their consent, all the way through to the use of big data predictive policing programs, you know, in an environment where there really aren't effective privacy rights. And this raises a lot of questions about people's ability to, you know, have any degree of anonymity online or even be able to criticize authorities in perfectly valid legal ways without that having consequences for other parts of their life, like their ability to enroll children in school. One other issue that I really think bears discussion here this afternoon, partly because it's been very much in the headlines in the last couple of days, is the situation in Xinjiang, which is, well, no longer a predominantly ethnically Turkic minority Muslim province, in the western part of the country, where we have long documented serious human rights violations that have accelerated significantly under the tenure of Chen Chuanguo, who is now the party secretary. He was previously the party secretary in Tibet, where he was very busy putting in place other kinds of repressive mechanisms. But over the last year, we have documented the government's use of what are essentially political education camps in which people are being arbitrarily detained. There's no legal basis for people's detention in these facilities, where they're essentially forced to study Xi Jinping thought. They're forced to study Chinese rather than using Uyghur. We have documented cases of torture and ill treatment. We have a large report that's coming out in September that will detail these and really the larger context of abuses in Xinjiang. Last but not least, one of the other trends of the last few years has been watching the Chinese government quite assiduously chip away at key international human rights mechanisms, not least within the UN. And here I'm talking about things like the treaty body reviews, the Human Rights Council, of which Australia is now a member. You know, I think we'll talk later about steps the Australian government can take, but I think given the discussion in Australia about Chinese political influence here, you know, one of the best contributions that Australia could make while a member of the Human Rights Council is to lead a comparable discussion about undue Chinese influence within UN human rights mechanisms. But we could keep going for quite some time, but I'll keep it to that for now.
Thanks, Sophie. So if I can turn to you, Natasha, at a practical level, what programs have you been involved in regarding human rights, and what have been some of your observations about working with these Chinese partners on the issue of human rights in China, given what a sensitive topic it is there?
Thank you. Thanks, Meriden, and thanks for the invitation to join you both this afternoon. I guess by way of background, to explain the program that the Australian Human Rights Commission manages, it's called the China-Australia Human Rights Technical Cooperation Program. And essentially, it was born out of the first annual human rights dialogue between the governments of China and Australia, where it was considered that if the two countries were going to engage in this political human rights dialogue every year, that it might be beneficial to have a practical program to sit behind that to help China achieve its human rights goals. So that was the genesis of the program. So in fact, that was 1998 when the China-Australia Human Rights Technical Cooperation Program was established. So this year we're celebrating 20 years of cooperation with China, and I think, certainly from my understanding, that is the longest unbroken program of cooperation with China on human rights on a bilateral relationship with any country in the world. So extraordinary in that sense, I suppose, the longevity of it. And the Australian government, the program is funded by the Australian Aid Program, by the Australian government, but is implemented by the Australian Human Rights Commission. And essentially, the government has recognised that as Australia's national human rights institution, we have that expertise, and therefore the commission is well placed to not only manage the program, but to provide the substantive input and the technical expertise. So what we do is we work with different Chinese partners. They're mostly government partners, and Meriden mentioned a few of those. We also work with quasi-government agencies, so the federations. We work with the All China Women's Federation, the Disabled Persons Federation of China as well, and we have one legal NGO in the program. And essentially what we're trying to do, I suppose, is work, feed into both the law reform that is going on in China, and particularly in the late 90s where there was a lot of that. It was around criminal justice. And feeding into that criminal justice reform program. And over time, what we've tried to do is work with the Chinese government, have them identify their human rights priorities, so there's buy-in. And then as long as we consider that Australia has the expertise, the relevant expertise, then we're in a position to work with them on those issues. And the kinds of things we have worked on for 20 years, almost the whole time we've been working on domestic violence, whether that's around service delivery or the national law. We work both, as Meriden said, at the national level. So we try and work in the law reform space, but we also have a lot of programs on the ground in the pilot locations all throughout China on a range of different things. So, for example, reproductive health rights, so the right to privacy of people's records, the right to choose has been a significant feature of the program. We are currently working on with the Ministry of Civil Affairs on the development of their child protection system. So there's a broad range, I suppose, of topics that we will cover, and it does change over the time. I think over the 20 years we've had, I don't know, something like 30 different topic areas that we've worked on. Some, you know, we've been able to do over a long period of time, and others the shelf life has been relatively short. And I think that reflects, I guess, where China is in terms of how far they're willing to go on a human rights topic. So sometimes we decide that actually we've probably reached the length of what that topic is. So, for example, civil society, working with civil society. Australia has well-founded history of government funding civil society to do the work they recognise they can't do. Obviously in China it's a different situation. So we've had some of those discussions around, do they need to be registered? Do they, what are the kind of restrictions that exist on them? Are there other ways of doing it? And sort of having those discussions. And it's always about encouraging. So I think one of the successes that we've had and the reason that the program has gone for as long as it has is that we don't come in and say, you're not doing it right. We recognise that in Australia we have our own human rights issues, and so we don't come from a place of authority in that respect. There are certainly areas where we would say, you know, we are doing better, but we talk about our experience, what we've learnt on our journey, our human rights journey in Australia, with a view to demonstrating how that is applicable in different contexts. Sometimes that's taken up and other times it isn't.
And have you seen changes? Have you seen things happen?
Yeah, we absolutely have, I think, in a range of areas. But I suppose to come back to the domestic violence, when we first started working in that space, you know, violence at home was absolutely a private issue. It was not a public issue. It was not something that was spoken about. And I think over that 20 years, we have seen absolutely that shift. And one of the things I think we tried to demonstrate was, you know, our women's movement, the things that have happened in Australia, these are things you would skip over because, it was a fight that didn't get us anywhere. How can you get to a place where women can talk about the issue, where they can seek assistance, they know where to go, how do you deliver those services in a way that doesn't re-traumatise, all of those kinds of things. The real breadth of it, the police role in domestic violence and how they respond to it. So we've had some very successful pilot. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that across the country, as it is not the case here, that there's a great response, but I think in the pilot projects we've had, we've seen some enormous change and success.
And Sophie, how does that, it sort of sounds like there's a tension to some degree between what's happening at this high macro political level, Xi Jinping and his direction, and then these sort of practical programs that are happening on the ground. How do you see that from your point of view?
Well, look, I think in a country of 1.4 billion people, you're bound to see a certain amount of variation. And, you know, one would never argue against providing the kind of technical assistance that you're talking about. But I also think it's very important to bear in mind how I think the Chinese government perceives that. You know, would you be able, if you wanted, to run a technical assistance program that looked at rampant discrimination in Xinjiang or religious repression in Tibet, right? I mean, I assume that, you know, there are limitations on what kinds of issues the project and the technical cooperation can answer. I think it's also very important to point out that the Chinese government points to that kind of cooperation. Again, it's a good thing. We're not arguing against it. You know, as, you know, evidence of good faith while simultaneously committing fairly serious human rights violations. And so I think that's a problem. You know, I also wonder about interventions that the Australian Human Rights Commission would make on behalf, for example, I'm coming with a hypothetical here. You know, let's say you're doing a technical cooperation program on how to combat corruption, you know, which has supposedly been a signature initiative of Xi Jinping. And I think we knew to be concerned about Xi's intentions within about 6 months of his taking office, when the first civil society group the authorities went after was actually a group of anti-corruption campaigners. These were people who literally were standing on street corners with signs that said virtually exactly the same thing that Xi and other senior party officials had said, but they got sent to jail for having done it publicly. You know, and I wonder about, you know, if you were running a program about that kind of cooperation, if and saw something like that happen, you know, does the commission weigh in and say that? I think it always makes me nervous when people say, you know, we don't come from a position of criticizing because we don't get everything right. I mean, hi, I'm an American in the age of Donald Trump. Okay, let's be very clear about this. You know, because if all governments took that position, then nobody would weigh in on anybody's behalf. The reason the international human rights architecture exists is because states fail. States lie. States don't protect their own people. They abuse them. And so, you know, to say sort of, unless everybody gets it all right, there's no room to weigh in, makes me a little bit uneasy.
So on that line, what does Human Rights Watch do to try and change and improve the situation in China, and how effective do you think that's been?
Well, I mean, one of the first things that we do is try our best to engage Chinese government officials. That's a little bit challenging since they don't really so much engage back. It's one of the only governments in the world that won't really talk to Human Rights Watch. You know, and that's a club that includes North Korea. I think the Venezuelans and the Zimbabweans don't talk to us. I'd have to check with my colleagues. But, you know, it's very difficult to have a conversation with the relevant authorities, despite, you know, voluminous correspondence that goes to them. You know, and so a lot of our efforts are first and foremost devoted to supporting activists. And one of the great success stories, I think, of China and human rights in the last 20 or 30 years really has been the rise of independent civil society. The level of rights awareness and people seeking redress through courts, for example. But, you know, our overwhelming impulse is to support those voices, but then to try to find allies in other powerful actors, typically other governments or parts of the UN, that will weigh in on behalf of rights-based solutions or interventions.
So there's a tension there, definitely, between, you know, a kind of an imperfect solution. We're not criticizing, we're not telling you we're wrong, but we're having some engagement, versus that line of saying, no, this is not right, but then not getting any engagement.
I think it's a mistake to think that it has to be all one or the other, right?
What's the in-between line that would be a good balance?
I think one of the mistakes that we see governments make, this is a generalization, one of the mistakes we see governments make is to believe that they have to choose one or the other, right? And one of the concerns that we've had about the bilateral human rights dialogues that about 10 or 15 different governments have pursued over the years, and here I'm talking about the official dialogues, not about the kinds of cooperation programs that Natasha runs, is that they sort of become a drag on all other kinds of diplomatic interventions on behalf of human rights in China. Because, you know, somebody from MFAT will say, we can't put out a statement about what's happening in Xinjiang because then we won't get a date for our human rights dialogue. Right. And so the space for interventions can narrow significantly, believing that you have to do one or the other, when our experience over the years has really been that, in fact, the kinds of technical cooperation and private interventions are actually taken more seriously and heard better if they are matched by public interventions from senior level officials, because in the Chinese political context, that's how you indicate seriousness of purpose.
Now, in the Australian case, is it right that you were saying that the technical cooperation program is the kind of practical backup to the bilateral human rights dialogue? Now, that human rights dialogue hasn't taken place for a few years, and my discussion with Chinese counterparts is that that's because China was sick of being lectured by Australia about human rights. So there is an example there where that kind of practical behind-the-scenes stuff is still going on, even though the bilateral official discourse has gotten a little bit politically sensitive, a little bit heated.
Yes.
So, and on that sort of question of the sensitivity of certain topics in human rights, are there some areas that you've found much easier to cooperate on and some areas that are just absolutely no-go? And how do you kind of negotiate these challenges or these areas of resistance?
Absolutely, there are areas that are easier to work on, and as I mentioned, it's about having China identify their priority areas. And so, perhaps unsurprisingly, that means when it comes to social, economic, cultural rights, that space is fairly easy to navigate. They will often put rights in those areas up for discussion and cooperation. It's obviously the political and civil rights where we find it hard to gain traction. So I suppose I should also say the program is a fairly small program relative to the aid budget. So it's not, we can only achieve so much. And so then I suppose one of the things that we think about is, with those limited resources, how much can we do and what's the fight going to be worth? So if we wanted to push for something in the civil and political space, that would be at the expense of potentially any engagement, part of it, all of it. It's unknown. But because it is such a small program, I think there is absolutely, I take everything you say, Sophie, and understand it. And but from my perspective, I suppose we consider that it's a fairly small program. We will work in the areas where they have identified they want to work in. So that's things like gender equality, reproductive health rights. There is a fair amount of criminal justice as well involved in the program. And the civil and political rights, you know, we don't even, then it's hardly ever on the table. But I can say that over the 20 years, one of the things that I think we've noticed is that when we have activities, and I'm thinking about activities where we engage a lot of young people. So we have one activity in the program that's been going on for about 15 years now. It engages around 500 university students every year, and we bring them all together. It's a Model United Nations conference. And so it's conducted in English, and it goes over 3 days, and you've got 500 Chinese students who are actively talking about human rights, who are taking on the persona of other nations, who are arguing, you know, in the UN fora about human rights. And the conversations that are had in the sidelines of the formal part of the program, I think for me, have been really interesting. We have a small number of Australian students who will participate in that each year. And I think we are hearing things now that we didn't hear before. So I guess the level of comfort about talking about things that would have been seen highly sensitive, young people certainly are feeling much more confident in raising them, even if it's in this small group space, rather than not talking about them at all. So I find that, you know, an understanding of rights, creating a demand for rights, is all part of the framework of the program and what we're trying to achieve. And again, very modest, but those are the opportunities, I suppose, if we have them, that we want to capitalize on.
Right. So this idea that some areas of human rights are sensitive and out of bounds and some are okay, there's a political purpose to that, isn't there? There must be a reason that you're putting a line around some things and you know, that gender's okay, but political rights are not okay. So I'm guessing that you don't buy the idea that social stability is more important than individual rights, this kind of Chinese rhetoric. I'm just taking a pun. But so what is it that you think is the purpose of having some of this repression, if you want to look at it that way? What is the purpose of having some things completely out of bounds, no way, don't touch them, these are none of your business, and some things that are okay? What's the purpose of these behaviour?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that are getting welded there together that don't necessarily follow. I think the government's purpose in saying social stability above all is about protecting the Chinese Communist Party's lock on political power and minimizing, if not eradicating, dissent. I think there are some issues that are perceived as less politically incendiary, and there's room to make concessions in ways that don't bump up against the parties or the government's power. And I think maybe if you looked, for example, at the trajectory of legal reform between sort of roughly the mid-80s and up to about 5 years ago, I'm going to channel Carl Minzner here, or try to, you know, that some of the initial legal reforms that were made were partly about sort of rationalizing the legal system across different realms and literally about the administration of justice. But then, you know, as the state moved through a series of different legal realms and started to bump up more against, you know, obligations that would have allowed people to make certain kinds of claims against the state, you started to see the drawbridge come up. And that as Xi Jinping came to power, in fact, what you saw, I think, was a real impulse to pass laws that created the veneer of legality for really unchecked state power, that made it legal to deny people the ability to have a lawyer of their choice, or to say certain kinds of things in public and not risk prosecution. So I think we don't want to mix up sort of the imperatives and the different realms on which there have long been sensitivities. And look, the fact of the matter is that, you know, sometimes, or let me say it this way, that, you know, some of the kinds of activists and civil society people that we've probably both worked with, you know, thought they had some sort of complaint or grievance that was not so controversial up until the moment that it was, because it threatened some particular kind of official's interests. And so you would see, for example, you know, somebody who was working on, I don't know, housing rights, that all of a sudden was, you know, getting prosecuted on some unbelievably harsh charge that was really disproportionate to what the core issue was. And so I guess I chafe a little bit against saying these areas, you know, have been or can be safe, and these are always going to be problematic, because we've seen some crossover in those realms.
And do you think this idea that that ultimately comes to, and I totally agree, that ultimately everything comes to CCP legitimacy and continued power. Right? You know, I think that in foreign policy as well, absolutely, that's the core. I think, though, that there are, that the CCP understands that its power and legitimacy does rest on a certain degree of buy-in from the majority of the population. And there is recent research out there that says this social, for example, social credit system is being seen positively. Do you think there's any argument that if most of the people feel that this is okay, that the party's legitimacy being built on that is in any way acceptable?
I think it's an impossible question to ask or to know what, you know, it's the reason I'm deeply skeptical about public opinion polling in China, right? I mean, you know, if you ask people who are at least some of whom are uneasy about, you know, confidence in sharing their views, you're going to get a pretty skewed reply. And look, I think the concerns about legitimacy are real for fairly obvious reasons, but I think that's why you see, you know, a PR campaign about the China dream, you know, and rhetoric and ideas like that, or, you know, a pitch to say China has reclaimed its rightful place in the world, you know, rather than answering, you know, some fairly basic socioeconomic demands that are fairly common across the country, right? I think you're seeing increasingly rhetorical responses in the place of any other kind of ideology or, in some cases, you know, actual fixes to everyday problems.
Natasha, the work that you do and that Australia does in China, how does that compare with other countries? Now, I understand that the UK has taken a decision to be slightly less publicly vocal about human rights than Australia has, and work more behind the scenes. Are they doing the same sorts of things that you're doing in China as well? Are there other actors in there doing similar stuff? Is there some communication among actors about what to do and the best way to do it?
Yeah, there is. And I think, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, our engagement has been the longest and has been unbroken for that time. And I think when we are visiting Beijing, we often meet with certainly like-minded countries about the dialogues that they're having, any programs of cooperation that they're conducting in the human rights space, for a couple of reasons. One is to obviously understand the landscape. You don't want to duplicate the resources that you have and work in sort of complementary areas, and obviously not wanting to contradict the work that we're doing. So I think there are attempts, and from those conversations with other countries, you know, it really reflects the current political situation. So I think, and most of those programs have been implemented by those governments. So the difference, I suppose, with having a national human rights institution implement the program rather than the government do it is that it's one stage removed. So I suppose that's assisted the Australian corporation, because when things are politically difficult, government, I think they would say, I don't want to speak on behalf of the Australian government, but I think they would say they would have those conversations with the Chinese government. They would do it either publicly or behind closed doors, however they do it. But this program can still continue. For other countries, I think what we've seen is they've had the programs on the ground and then those have been suspended because of a political incident. And that's one of the levers that they've pulled, and they've chosen to do that. The Australian government hasn't chosen to do that. And you mentioned the break in the dialogue. This, you know, it's totally a matter for the Australian government where they continue to fund this work and to support it. They've chosen to do so despite the fact that China, that they haven't been able to get a dialogue date.
And so, actually, can I ask a quick follow-up? Sure. I'm curious to know, are your efforts subject to the foreign NGO management law?
No.
Because?
Bilateral program between the two governments, so it's agreed.
So it is considered, it's considered state to state.
Yes, it is.
But sorry, by way of explanation, a new law went into effect at the beginning of 2017 that fairly radically curtails and places enormous scrutiny on foreign NGOs operating inside China. And it was introduced into the guise of sort of rationalizing the way those groups were registered. But it creates enormous opportunities for the government to surveil financing or shut it down or scrutinize program activities. And it requires foreign NGOs to all register and have a government partner in their work, which has been an enormous obstacle for lots of different kinds of groups, you know, even ones that are working on those supposedly more anodyne issues. Yeah. So I was curious to know if that in any way cut into your efforts.
It hasn't. So for you, it's a careful and skillful balancing act between being government enough to be not non-government and be affected by these laws, but not so government as to be affected by the bilateral relationship. I mean, Australia and China have had a pretty tricky time in the bilateral relationship recently. And has that caused any challenges or any sense of resistance at all in your work?
It's hard to know. It is hard to know whether it impacts.
I'm glad you're answering that question.
I think, you know, I can speculate, but I couldn't say with any confidence, yes, absolutely. But as with any kind of, bilateral relationship, when you're working in a sensitive area, there are ebbs and flows. Sometimes things are going really well and other times they're not. Sometimes you know the reason for that and other times you don't. And I think, when we might hit a bit of a rocky patch, and when I say rocky patch, you know, that might just be a slowdown in communication. It could be a whole range of things. You know, we can speculate whether it's related to the political. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe it just is everyone in that section is in the field. We don't know, so. But it has the potential, I suppose, always.
That's right. And we'll open up to the floor for questions now. I do want to just emphasise, please, when the mic comes to you, please give us your name and your affiliation.
Thank you. Brian Everingham, and in this particular context, National Parks Association of New South Wales. I've noticed that in China, when it was opening up, the first space for NGOs were environmental groups. I'm curious as to whether or not, under the current restrictive practices, they too have been affected or wrapped up into this process.
Sure, I'll try to give you a concise answer there. Yes, there has been some more room at points along the way for environmental groups, partly because there has been publicly articulated concern about the physical environment. You know, the party is not deaf to popular concerns. It can't be entirely. You know, I think that's led to some better laws, both on, you know, regulating certain kinds of substances, for example, better disclosure about how companies are operating, and a little bit more room for input from domestic and international environmental NGOs. But there certainly have been moments where we've seen environmental groups take it in the neck like everybody else. Again, not necessarily because of the substance of the position that they were taking, but rather because they were perceived to be getting too much attention domestically or internationally, or they had exposed problematic behavior by local officials.
Thank you. My name is Damien. I'm from the New South Wales State Government. Thank you both for your talk today. It's been very informative. My question is more about civil society. And we're now having a generation of millennials and Generation Z, whatever we want to call them, entering into adulthood and into the workforce who haven't experienced things like the Cultural Revolution or the Tiananmen Square. And I was wondering whether or not, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and as you know, people get out of poverty and as their needs change, their wants change, do you see an increase in civil society inputs into these matters?
Can I have a go? I just would like to add something to that. When I was living in China a few years ago, this question about whether or not young people were interested in issues like Tiananmen was really interesting. I was doing a Chinese language program. There was a young American in our class who said to our Chinese teacher, "Hey, you know, I've got to tell you about Tiananmen." Smuggled in some papers. You know, this is Tiananmen. This is what happened. The next week said, "Now, teacher, did you read that? What did you think?" And the teacher said, "Oh, yeah, it was a bit boring." And it was absolutely fascinating to see, and this is not just an isolated case, how often, how many times young people may know about it, but just don't see the relevance of it. And they will say, you know, here we are now, everything's okay, what does that matter? Our lives are better maybe the government did the right thing. So in terms of, you know, whether or not they, as they become increasingly educated, as their Maslow hierarchy of needs, they go up that ladder, whether or not that immediately turns to sort of feeling agitated about rights, I'm not convinced that that happens.
Sophie?
I am. I mean, let me share with you what is inherently anecdotal information. And even before Meriden tacked on her part, your question was about 10 dissertations waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's a big question. I can tell you that, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, I would go to campuses, you know, in the U.S. here, in other parts of Asia, and give talks about China and human rights issues. And almost invariably, there would be students who from the mainland who were sitting in the front row who would write down everything I said and photograph me constantly. And as soon as I was done talking, I would get what I came to think of as the speech, right? That I was not being objective, I had it all wrong, we never applauded the good stuff, we only focused on the bad stuff, that we were insulting, blah, 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 blah. You know, as of about 5-ish years ago, that sort of had stopped happening. And I didn't know why, and we could all reach totally different conclusions about why this happens, right? But I was starting to get questions from students from the mainland, broadly and abstractly, about human rights and how they would apply in certain situations, but not necessarily asking questions about how it played out in China. Now, I get people come into my office, young people who are, you know, and again, these are admittedly somewhat self-selecting groups, you know, young people who are coming to our office who plonk down and ask really hard questions about Xinjiang, about Hong Kong, about what the rule of law means, about everything we write about. And, you know, and they're asking both about China and about the U.S. or other parts of the world. And it's a very different kind of conversation that I do find very encouraging. You know, from our perspective, the $64,000 question is, what does that turn into, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the road? And are those people, you know, who could imagine themselves in positions of authority?
And that goes maybe as well to your point, Natasha, that you were saying before about these conversations that that young people are having, asking these questions about human rights, debating the issues of human rights, taking on the perspective of other countries about that. So do you feel that they are building up building up that demand?
I think absolutely. The conversations that we're having with, you know, and it is anecdotal, but with large numbers of Chinese students and their understanding and their desire to know, and also questions about how they're perceived. So how does Australia perceive us? And you know, those are great conversations to be having, that awareness, and I think it will increase the demand for rights.
That's right, and I think, but so to your point about what does this mean, though, in future, is really the key. You know, do these people get into positions of power? How long do they last if they get into positions of power? I mean, from my experience, the people that I know who've questioned these sorts of things are all the ones who have left the country.
Well, right. And I mean, would people ask these questions at home? You know, would I be able to teach a class in which people were asking these questions standing in downtown Beijing, right? I mean, there are a lot of different variations there, but I think humans are inherently curious, and especially once they've got hold of the idea that they are entitled to certain things and certain kinds of treatment, they're not generally inclined to let that go.
Thanks. We could really debate that a lot. I'll take a question from down here, please.
Sophie, I was wondering if you could get into a little bit, Megha Rajagopalan from BuzzFeed News.
Ah, we love you.
Love you too.
There you are.
In the flesh. I was wondering if you could get into a little bit more detail about the mechanisms China uses to either obstruct or shape debate at the UN about human rights abuses.
I'll try to give you a shorter version than a 100-page report, but what we've documented is really everything from harassing and intimidating treaty body committee members in their home countries or offering them inducements to not raise certain kinds of questions to trying to block certain kinds of NGOs from even being part of certain discussions, all the way through to arguably the most brain-bending part of the research we did last year, were a series of objections lodged through the NGO committee without getting into the Byzantine nature of how these things are structured within the UN. How China worked with two or three other governments to insist that NGOs that were applying for accreditation to be able to operate within different kinds of UN forums had to change language in their literature, even if those organizations didn't actually do any work on China, right? And a classic example was insisting that Taiwan be referred to, that it be Taiwan, China, right? That it couldn't be Taiwan, ROC, or that, you know, Tibet be referred to as a part of China, this kind of thing. And so it was, you know, it's a thousand different tiny little ways of inserting and insisting on the Chinese government's view of the world or blocking criticisms.
Do you think it's been effective?
Oh yeah, I think some of it has been extremely effective.
And do you think other countries are buying this different approach to human rights or trying these changes that China's trying to assert?
Oh yeah, and there's no better example of that than the resolution that the Chinese government ran at the Human Rights Council in June of this year. The government decided to introduce a resolution on the win-win nature of international cooperation on human rights. And for just about every person in this room, if you'd read this document, you would sort of shrug and think, that doesn't seem to be problematic. It sounds a little weird, but I don't see why it's a problem. It was enormously problematic in that it essentially removed the idea of holding states accountable or independent organizations from having a role in these kinds of discussions. The short version of this story was that, you know, the original version was so bad that it was not that hard for China to make some modest improvements such that lots of governments either then said, yeah, it's fine, and voted for it, thus endorsing language that we think will ultimately be used to try to start gutting the actual legally binding treaties, or in Australia's case, took the really courageous stand of abstaining. That was a huge mistake on Australia's part. Only one government objected to this document, and that was the U.S. And that's where we are.
Thank you. I'll take a question from here in the middle, please, this gentleman.
Thank you, everybody. My name is Mehmet Çelikçi. I'm a migration agent. I have done significant amount of work for the Uyghur people. There are about 20 people here in this room of Uyghur background. And I can guarantee you, they are even, most of them are even scared to talk in this room. Forget about somewhere else. They all have this difficulty of, impossibility of even communicating with their parents, brothers, sisters, and siblings or relatives. All their passports of their relatives are confiscated. And there are some people also in Australia who are still Chinese citizens with Chinese passports. Their passports have expired. They want to get renew their passport, but it's not possible because they are given a one-way ticket, a travel document to go back and get that passport from China, which means go and get into the concentration camp.
I'm sorry, if you got a question that you
yes,
wanted to get
yes.
to, thank you.
Maybe I should come to my question.
Please.
There are also some people of Australian who have Australian permanent resident visas who happened to make that mistake and go to China in the last 1.5 to 2 years. They are not able to come back. Some of them are already in concentration camps and their relatives are in Australia, all crying, trying to do something about it. So my question is, would you suggest anything that can be done, maybe on behalf of, to approach the Australian government officials to ask for help to bring their relatives back to Australia? Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And for all the people in the room who are of Uyghur descent, we are deeply concerned about what's happening in that region and to people's family members. It is an abuse on a scale we have not seen in a long time, and it is of grave concern to us. I think we want to see governments, not just Australia's, but any government that has a naturalized Uyghur diaspora, among other things, reach out to that community and collect lists of missing family members, even if it's not within the Australian government's power or jurisdiction to insist on those people being released because they're not Australian citizens, I think it's a powerful gesture of solidarity and sympathy for what's happening to the family members of Australian citizens. I think this is also the moment for Australia to use its position as a member of the Human Rights Council to, among other things, spearhead or support a joint statement of concern about Xinjiang that other governments could sign on to, you know, and or argue for something like an investigation into what's happening in the region. There are a lot of options available within, you know, sort of within the scope of the Human Rights Council. There's no reason that Australia and other governments couldn't come together to form something like a Friends of Xinjiang coalition for those governments to talk to each other, both about what's happening to diaspora communities, but also how they can come together to put some pressure on Beijing to close these camps immediately, to let people go, to account for people's whereabouts, you know, and especially for people who want to leave the country, which is a black letter human right, to let them go.
Yes, Feng Chongyi from University of Technology, Sydney. Recently, there are a lot of argument in the public and politics and media. There's a boil an argument that if you raise the issue of democracy or human rights with Chinese government, it will jeopardize the trade, economic engagement, and even the normal foreign relationship with China. Do you have a strategy or better strategy to deal with that kind of argument?
I assume that's a question for me. It's nice to meet you, and I'm glad to see you here. I think I would go back to the premise. You know, we've certainly seen Beijing follow through on economic threats, for example, more in the last couple of years than we have in the past. I think that's happening partly because governments haven't been good enough about pushing back against it in the past. But even if you unpack, for example, the apocryphal case of Norway and the Nobel Peace Prize, I think there are interesting reports out there about China's ongoing purchase of things like heavy drilling equipment from Norway, even at a time when relations were at an all-time low. I mean, it's relatively rare that you see the Chinese government set aside an interest just because it's upset about a human rights issue. I think that doesn't happen terribly often. And, you know, conversely, we see that pressure can work, and there's no better case of that at the moment than finally seeing Liu Xia free, right? I mean, that was 8 straight years of governments, the UN, private citizens from all over the world, organizations like ours, pushing China publicly and privately to get to a point where the calculation was made in Beijing that it was less painful to let her go than to hang on to her, right? I mean, I wouldn't ever let go of the efficacy of that strategy either.
We've just got a couple of minutes left, and what I'd like to do, unless there's any more burning questions from the audience, would just be to ask the panelists for a kind of closing reflection on where you think the trajectory for the future might be going. Do you have any sort of sense of optimism about where things might be heading? Where, if so, kind of where those, I mean, you mentioned this case of Liu Xia, you know, what are the opportunities? Where are there possible chinks? Where are there ways to succeed? And do you think that there is room for positivity when we're thinking about human rights in China in the future? I'll start with you, Sophie, and then Natasha, you can have the last word.
Points of positivity. I think a couple of thoughts don't necessarily follow logically from one to the other. I think, you know, observing people such as this gentleman here who is rightly pointing out that, you know, or reminding us that people who are from China who are now citizens of other countries can make use of the rights that are available to them to push for better treatment of their family members or to push China for better rights compliance. You know, this is no longer, you know, we no longer live in a world in which human rights abuses in China stay strictly within China's borders. There's a way in which there's an advantage to that because it means that there are more levers for us all to pull. But I think the other point of not just optimism, but awe, really, you know, I'm in awe of activists and civil society people and people who are working on legal reform in China who get up every day and keep at it, you know, even in the face of the prospect that they're never going to be the Minister of Justice or that the work that they're doing might cost them years in prison and away from their families, or that there might be an enormous personal cost and possibly not the kind of, you know, professional or substantive success that they want. I think there's a breathtaking amount of courage on display every single day that we take our hats off to.
Natasha? I suppose I make my comments in the context of what we're seeing regionally and globally and in general, particularly in the region, wind back on human rights. And I think it's hard to be optimistic in that, in the face of that. But I think wherever you have opportunities, you have to have those discussions. You have to try and work with others to advance human rights. And there are different ways of doing that. They won't always be successful, but I think it's incumbent on us to keep doing that. And I think in my personal experience, where I've met human rights champions in China, within government or civil society, that always spurs me on to keep doing the work that we do. So yeah, I think we should be optimistic and we should keep on moving forward.
Great.
This issue is huge and complex, and there are so many areas we didn't get to, and there are so many areas that we could have gone into in more depth. But I'd like to thank our panelists so much for their expertise and their experience that they've brought today. Please join me in thanking Natasha and Sophie for joining us today.